What gets measured gets done. That is a mantra by John Derbyshire, who is our next guest and the CEO founder of SmartSuite. SmartSuite is a work management platform that allows organizations to manage any business process or project. I told him I need to use that mantra in my life, what gets measured gets done, because a lot of times we know we work towards a goal, but we don't measure our progress. As always, you guys are listening to Mindset Matters with your host, RJ DeLeon. We know in life, mistakes and failure are inevitable. So we want to learn about the mindset shifts our guests have made to make them successful. Think about this as an audio mastermind to help you navigate challenges of all kinds. That being said, John, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here. I love this topic of Mindset Matters, and I'm ready to dig in with you.
Absolutely. You are not short of lessons learned being the CEO of SmartSuite. Give us a background. How did you come about SmartSuite? What was before that? And give us some of your journey.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes of just some background information that helps. So I live now in Southern California, but I grew up in a small town in Kansas, kind of maybe 8,000 people, one stoplight type of town. Went to college at Kansas State, played football and went to school at the same time. Graduated school and decided I needed a change. And I actually just packed up and drove to California. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. But I had a friend of a friend that knew somebody that lived in a city that let me sleep on their floor for about 3 months until I kind of found my footing, found my first job and got started. That was in a public accounting firm that also did consulting. And I was more interested in the consulting side that was there. I was able to leverage that job. Fast forward maybe 7 or 8 years, I became a direct admit partner at Ernst & Young and ran one of their global practices. We had about 1,500 people in that practice. I left Ernst & Young after running that for 4 or 5 years and started my own company, Archer Technologies, which was a no-code platform that focused on allowing organizations to manage risk around technology. Think of banks. The top 29 of the top 30 banks in the U.S. were customers of that company. We helped them bring online banking to customers by understanding all the things they needed to secure around the systems and technology that related to online banking and the regulations they need to be in compliance with. That company did extremely well. We sold it in 2010 to one of the big tech guys. I stayed with him a year, officially retired, opened a family foundation, did a lot of fun stuff for 6, 7, 8 years. The truth is I got bored. I'm a tech guy. I wanted to get back into tech. So I started SmartSuite about 3 years ago. We spent the first 2.5 years with about 100 developers building the core platform before we ever announced what we were doing to anyone or even brought on our first customer. So we've been around for about 6 months from the customer's perspective. We have a couple thousand customers that have joined us in that 6 month period of time. But as a company, we've been around about 3 years since we spent so much time building the core platform. I'm married, 2 kids that are adult kids, have a dog, live in Southern California on the beach. That's kind of my story. Yeah.
And it's a great story from humble beginnings, sleeping on the floor in California, making a big shift from a one stoplight town to now doing the larger than life things that you're doing now. Has to be quite a journey. And a lot of transitions there. I guess we could start from the beginning.
Yeah.
A lot of people in your shoes are too scared to take the leap, to leave a one-stoplight town, and then, of all things, go sleep on the floor of a friend of a friend's place. Yeah. How were you able to make that decision?
You know, looking back, there were a lot of factors that kind of came in at the same time that I think that took me down that path. But I just knew one thing for sure, that in the town that I grew up in was right outside of Wichita, Kansas. We called that the big city when I was growing up. And we would drive there. And I just knew that I wanted to get into the tech space and the consulting space. I really didn't understand what just yet. You know, I was pretty young, just right out of school, right out of college. But I knew I needed to change my environment to create opportunities to do what I wanted to do. To be honest, I'd never seen the ocean. I'd never traveled outside of three or four states around Kansas until that point. And that was mainly for sports when we would travel for baseball, basketball, football, whatever it might be. So it was a pretty big decision to make. And what I ended up doing was I sold pretty much everything that I had, made a 3 car payments in advance, packed everything else in my little S10 Blazer and drove to California. And at that time, this is back in, 91, 92.
Okay.
Maybe 1990. So it's been a while, right? But there's no cell phones. Really was an email back then.
Right.
I had a conversation with a friend that said, "Hey, John, I live about 2 hours outside of LA. If you decide to come out, I'll let you stay with me for a while." And we had that discussion over Christmas. Fast forward 5 or 6 months, I start driving, no contact with him. I show up at the apartment, the address that he gave me, and a guy answers the door and said, "Hey, I'm so sorry, but Rod doesn't live here anymore. He moved."
Oh, wow.
But he told us that somebody might be coming and you're welcome to sleep on our floor for a couple months. So it was a pretty stressful situation of everything was new to me, meeting people for the first time. Kind of, I didn't have any money to go stay anywhere else. It was what it was. So I just spent my time driving to LA interviewing for jobs. And I happened to have an interview in LA and then another interview in San Diego. And I drove through Newport Beach, California, which is right on the coast. And I just stopped and said, "I've never seen anything like this. I've never even seen anything like this in the movies. It's just so beautiful. I want to find a job in this area." So I really focused on that. It took me a few months to kind of get my foothold. But that one decision that I made at that point in time in my life has affected every year since then in such a dramatic way. You know, I still have a lot of great friends from my hometown. They're the same person that I am. They just didn't take that chance or that leap of faith to leave the situation that they were in, or they didn't know how to maybe leave that situation that they were in. And our lives are very different, not because we're different people, but just because of the things that we're able to do and opportunities that we can take advantage of 30 years later.
I think one of the biggest aspects there is being able to be comfortable taking that risk. But you did say something that I don't want to skim over this because it's a very, it's pivotal for this whole story. And that was, you knew you wanted something different. And to achieve that different, you had to change your environment to do the things that you wanted to do.
Right.
Yeah. Now,
Yeah. I was going to say that at the time, you know, I understood the word technology and these tech companies that I was starting to hear about for the first time, you know, Microsoft, Apple, you know, that first wave. And I just knew that I would never have an opportunity in the environment that I was in. I was just too far away from that to even learn that was there. So when I did find my first job in Southern California, what I was most interested in was taking the job where I could get the most exposure and learn the most things over a short amount of time. It was some about the money I needed to live, but I wasn't on a money grab. I was on this knowledge grab that was there. And as I talk to a lot of young people, as they're kind of starting their careers, you know, I've just seen through my career and people that I've worked with that the people that focus on putting themselves in situations to gain knowledge, just to continue to learn after college for those first 3, 4, 5 years, tend to excel at a faster rate than people that don't. Maybe somebody that chased that extra $5,000 or $10,000, but that job is a desk job working on spreadsheets all day, every day. And that's what you know. You don't get the chance to continue to grow.
That is such an important lesson. Being able to understand how to get further in life and not chasing the big bucks today, but limiting yourself in the future. And that's exactly what I heard from your story, from changing your environment to be able to accomplish the things that you want to do, and you obviously have, but also not chasing the dollars. Obviously, we do all have to live, but instead of focusing on the short term, I need to focus on making more monetary compensation you were more focused on the learning aspect and the growth aspect and putting yourself in the best position so that you could excel in the future, not necessarily right here and now.
Yeah, I think a lot of that as well is, you know, for a lot of younger, you know, 20 somethings that leave home for the first time and you're on your own, the last thing that you want is to make that phone call back home saying, I need help, or I'm coming home, or right. So that was a huge motivation for me, was I did not want to make that phone call. So I was going to do everything I could to be successful without needing to go back to, you know, to my family.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said about the times that we grew up in as well, because today with all the new technology platforms, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, everything, we live in this life of instant gratification and also a glorified persona of life. A lot of people, instead of chasing self-fulfillment, we're chasing our outside image.
Right.
And that's when you said in 91, I was maybe, I think I was maybe 10 years old around then. I remember those days too. And I say I lived through this transition where the Instagrams and the Snapchats all came in. So I'm like, I live on both sides. So I really enjoy that. And I think that's a big portion of what the younger generation's missing. We're all chasing these bigger than life lifestyles.
Right.
While avoiding the main issue, the intrinsic values, the motivations to learn and educate ourselves.
Yeah.
So, I'll share some thoughts on that. Yeah.
I love to hire young people out of school. I've been really successful in doing that with a couple of companies that we built. And I enjoy it for a couple of reasons. Number one, you're getting kids right out of school that are eager to learn, and they don't have any habits that are different than what you want to teach them yet, right? So you can teach them the job the way you would like to do things in the company that you're in. And it's easy to kind of mold them that's there. But, you know, I love the energy that they come with. And we started a program in multiple companies now called the Associates Program. So we hire them out of school. And for the first year, every 3 months, we move them into a new department in the company. They typically do 4 to 5, so it could last a little more than a year. So they get the chance to do some products, some QA, some marketing, some sales, some, you know, whatever. They pick those areas that are there. The goal is to teach them how a business actually operates, a software company, which is what I specialize in, how that company operates. At the end of the year, we then work with them to pick, you know, what's the area or areas that you're most interested in. But what we find the value is that they've now had exposure to all these different departments. They've made connections with these people. When they're in their role, they're more successful because now it's easy for me to go talk with RJ because I've met with him, you know, before, right? And have that conversation that's there. And we really stress to people in their 20s that, you know, during that period of time in your life, what's most important is keep learning. Like if you're doing a job and you're doing the same thing over and over every day, that's really not learning, right? So maybe it's time to let's move you somewhere else and put somebody else in that role and let you learn the next thing. So now you can bring value back to all those together. So I'm a huge proponent of giving, you know, Gen Zers now the ability to just learn and operate inside of mainly smaller companies that I've been a part of, meaning 500 or less kind of people in a company.
I really enjoy that cross training of your individuals because, like you said, it allows them to experience the business as a whole. Where I went to school for accounting, and when I tried to move outside of an accounting role at very large organizations, they did not like that.
Right.
There was no training. And then at the same time, I was not allowed to ask questions, and I had to do things how they were historically done.
Right.
Even though, you know, accounting had taught us professional skepticism, always ask, like, why are things done this way? And right. When things seemed to, you know, cross those lines, I asked the questions and I'd actually get my hand slapped.
Yeah. Let me give you a good story on that. That's right. So I'm an accounting and finance grad as well. Right. And I kind of went through school. I enjoyed the finance side because I enjoyed understanding how companies actually made money. I was more interested in that side. And I enjoyed the accounting side because I felt like I needed that knowledge to kind of dig into the details at times. When I graduated from Kansas State, I was a 3.0 student, just an average student. All the big X accounting firms came in and interviewed people. I couldn't even get an interview. I couldn't even get to the interview with the guys. So disheartening. That's one of the reasons that said, you know, I have to have a change in environment, and I moved to California. But what happened, which is really interesting, if you kind of look at the case study, you look at the top people that graduated that year at Kansas State in accounting that went to the big X firms. A lot of them went to Ernst & Young, which was kind of in Kansas City at the time. You fast forward 7 years, 8 years, Ernst & Young recruited me in as a direct admit partner because of all the experience that I had gained in Southern California, right, doing all these different things. And now I was a partner in charge of all these people that I went to school with that got the job. And it taught me at the time that this, just go keep learning all these new experiences, because that creates value for you as a, not just as a person, but in the, what you have to offer an organization, right, with your skill set.
I was going to say, you can even get an interview with Big Four, but then you came in as a director for Big Four. That's a terrific lesson. You want to focus on the continued education, the overall experiences. You know, we always wondered that too, when working for these larger companies, why wouldn't they hire from within? And typically it's because you don't have the diversity of training. You don't have the multiple organizations, the different functions to be able to be successful in that role. That completely makes sense. Thank you for sharing that story.
Sure. Go ahead. No, I was going to say, are you familiar with the book Outliers from Malcolm Gladwell?
I am familiar with it. I have not read it. So okay. Teach away.
All right. I'll give you just a couple of minutes on Outliers. So Malcolm Gladwell is an author, very well-known author, that loves to dig into stories about why, right? He doesn't want to just tell the story. He wants to understand the why part of the story. So what he did in the book Outliers is he picked 5 or 6 different groups of people or individuals, and he said, I'm going to dig into their story, but I don't want to just tell the story. I want to get to that moment in time that was the why, and why Bill Gates became Bill Gates, why Steve Jobs became Steve Jobs, why the Beatles were so successful in what people thought was a single year. And out of that, and you need to read the book, because it's fascinating if you're an entrepreneur to kind of learn some of these things. If you look at Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and HP, all of those guys were born in 1957 or 58. Every one of them that started these big companies. And that moment in time, and the geography that they were in, had the impact on them starting Microsoft and Apple and HP in that one little area geography they were in. But the big thing that he came back was this concept of 10,000 hours. And he found across all these different disciplines that once you've achieved 10,000 hours inside of a particular discipline, that you then become an expert in that area. And that's when people become experts, and then they have opportunities, and they could use the expertise to go after the opportunity. That's when you see some really great things happening, whether it's a doctor, a lawyer, a baseball player. He talks about hockey players in Canada and why 78% of the hockey players were born within 3 months of each other every year for like 20 years. He tried to figure out the why. It's because when you start hockey and they say everybody born between January and December, the person that was born earlier could have 11 month advantage over the same person that's in the league with them. And he just found that started at age 6 and transitioned all the way through their professional careers for different reasons. So it's a fascinating book on kind of the why part of things.
Perfect. And appreciate that quick dive into the knowledge. And I was going to say, we could also attribute to why John Derbyshire is so successful by taking the risk, leaving the town, understanding that you had to change your environment, and focusing on education, continual learning, rather than more monetary compensation. Now you're doing these big things. You're a director at a big four firm. And now you're a large entrepreneur that actually came out of retirement because you want to stay active. So can we talk about that transition, though, from leaving a big four firm to then being a founder of different companies? Because that sort of leads us to uncomfortable transitions where you have this set job, you have the comfort and the stability, but now you're leaving all that behind to then create something new.
Yeah, I think that for me, that was a really difficult decision, right? I was a partner in a big X firm. I was the youngest partner in the whole company. I had a big career path in front of me. They were paying me way more than what I ever thought I would make from a compensation perspective. But I wasn't fulfilled. Like I love the people I worked with and some of the work, but I didn't love the day-to-day grind of being a partner and providing services. I felt like I wanted to build software and solve the problem and sell software so that I had a solution to the problem instead of the service. So what I learned at Ernst & Young is I had the chance to kind of travel the globe and meet with customers. They have the who's kind of list of customers. And I felt like I found a problem area that we continued to provide services for that could be solved by providing software products, a no-code platform, you know, what we call it today, to manage processes around risk and compliance in the same way that you manage accounts receivables, accounts payable, payroll, those types of things as well. So I spent, I left my position at Ernst & Young. I spent the first 3 months just thinking about and trying to solve that problem. And the light bulb came on at the end of the third month. It just hit me like I figured it out finally. And I went and approached at the time a customer called EDS, which was one of the largest outsourcing companies in the world. They had like 130,000 employees. I approached them with the idea on a little floppy disk and said, I haven't written any code yet, but I can solve this problem for you. And here's how it's going to affect all the relationships that you have on the consulting side. They signed off on that before we ever hired our first developer. So I was in a unique position that I left. I signed a contract. I had to deliver on the contract, but I had my first customer before we actually started officially the company. And then that company just exploded over the next 7 or 8 years with kind of the who's list of the Fortune 100. 75% of the Fortune 100 became customers of that product.
Wow. So that was a company or a software that you produce, and that's way before Smart Suite?
It was, yeah. So that was back in 2000. So we built a product at the same time that Mark Benioff built Salesforce.com that you're probably aware of. We both took the same approach with no-code platforms. It was interesting. We both had similar ideas and our implementations, even the UIs, were very similar on how you solve the problem. He focused on sales and marketing. We focused on what became governance, risk, and compliance that's there. Right. That company today, Archer, does about $750 million a year in recurring revenue. It's the leader in that space that's there, just like Salesforce is and kind of the sales and marketing side.
Wow. Yeah, you're using a lot of terminology there that like no-code platform. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but maybe I should research it after this call.
Yeah, I'll give you 30 seconds to tell you what no code means is instead of having a developer that actually writes code for you and builds things, no code means I'm just going to use drag and drop capabilities to move fields on a form and to build the process the way that I want. But I don't have to be a developer. I just know the process that I want, and I'm just using these tools to make it happen. And that's kind of the future of software development that's really happening today, is that you have hundreds of new software companies that call themselves no code. It's just a fancy word for using drag and drop to build things as opposed to writing code.
To design an interface that fits your needs.
Rather. Exactly.
Instead of having to call a developer each time you need to move a widget or a window.
Exactly.
Very interesting stuff. Then you left Archer and you retired.
I did.
When you retired?
officially retired, started a family foundation. We focused on women's initiatives, youth programs, and entrepreneurial programs. I focused on the entrepreneurial side. My wife and my mother focused on the other two. So we had a 15,000 square foot incubator in Kansas City where we would bring young startups in and allow them to work for free in that environment. We provided a series of professional resources around accounting, finance, development, and marketing, where we would help them in those areas as they were getting started. And the goal was to not just start, great companies that would go on to be billion-dollar companies. It was to focus on lifestyle entrepreneurs that wanted to build a business that became a family business that was their career long-term in different different areas. So we were focused on the little guy and some of the big guys at the same time. During that journey, I had the chance to personally invest in about 400 startups. So I had the chance to work with a lot of entrepreneurs. And as I would work with them, one of the key things that we would always come back to is, what software should we have to run our business as we grow? And I got frustrated that there wasn't a platform that did the things that I felt needed to be done to just make that easy, or they were too expensive for a startup to be able, a young company to afford. So we just said, we're just going to build it. Like, I'm going to take 2 or 3 years with about 100 developers, what we had. I'm going to build this core platform that allows any size company to manage and run their business on one platform. The reality is most businesses have 5 to 7 different products that they kind of use to run their business each day. We want to bring that down to maybe 2 to 3, right? We'd love to get it to 2. That's there. But our goal is, so now you don't have to pay for 7 products with your annual license. You just pay for 2 or 3. We provide 90-95% of the capabilities that you need directly inside of Smart Suite. So Smart Suite's a work management platform, which is just a fancy word for it's a place that you can put all your processes to run your specific business, whether you're a construction company, a real estate company, a doctor, a lawyer, a bank. We have over 2,000 customers just in the last 6 months across every kind of industry and across 15 different languages. So we're about 50% of our customer pool is outside of the US.
Perfect. A sort of one-stop shop so that you're no longer fragmented across multiple platforms. And to help the little guys, the entrepreneurs that are starting that can't pay for these expensive software systems. Like, I would say Salesforce. If you're a small sales team, you can't afford that.
Right.
And I really enjoy that. It seems like there's a lot of philanthropic backing to that. And
yeah, I was going to say, if you're 1 to 3 users, it's free, right? So we're trying to help the little guys. If you're a nonprofit organization, you get 50% off any plan that you pick for us. So we are trying to give back in that way through the software and help companies basically be better at managing and running their business, whether you're a nonprofit organization, a startup company, or, we have a $50 billion hedge fund on the real estate side that uses us to manage all their real estate assets, right? And kind of everything in between.
That's amazing. I think divine intervention has put us together today, because currently I am very frustrated trying to scale my construction company. Yeah. And it's me and a team of 2. So 3 of us all together, under 3 users. And we're trying to figure out a management platform that we can run everything, our projects or everything together in day to day. And we seem, even now, we're fragmented across a couple platforms and we're trying to pick what is the best solution for us.
Sure. Yeah, we have lots of great examples of young construction companies that, I'd be happy to have myself or somebody on our team show you. But to help people like you, our product comes with 200 process templates, and they're broken down by category. So if you come in and say, I'm a construction person, real estate person, you just click on that and we show you, here's all the things that we can do to help you manage that process. Or in some cases, this kind of goes back to my Ernst & Young days. Everything in Ernst & Young was thought of as a process. So I kind of think that way. And so if you're going to manage something, we want to give you a best in class process, a way to manage that. And you might not yet know what best in class means. So we'll give you, here's the Cadillac version, with all the bells and whistles. But maybe here's the intermediate version that you don't need all of that just yet. here's, you know, it's a little simpler.
Sure. So with all that experience, what I heard is you think of everything from a process standpoint. Do you use that to help your choices in your day-to-day now? Even, you know, coming out of retirement per se, or daily choices of what you're going to pursue to keep yourself busy now that you're in this position?
Yeah, that's, for me personally, like my passion is around building software. And the reason I love that is because I get to interact with people that are trying to solve real problems in their business, and they understand how they want to run their business. And I get the chance to learn their business and then show them in our products or other products how I can make their life better. And I enjoy that conversation, that whole process, that interaction that takes place there.
Terrific. So you're still involved in the day-to-day?
Oh, I run every part of software development inside of our company, because that's just my passion. And, you know, we talked about mindsets at the beginning a little bit, and I used to feel funny about being a CEO and wanting to be so close to the product. Like I spend 30 minutes every morning with our lead designer working on new features down to the pixel settings on the interface that's there. I used to feel like that was, I shouldn't do that. People tell me if you're CEO, you shouldn't do that. And I realized over time that you absolutely should do that. Like that's what your customers expect. If you're the best person that has that knowledge, you know, I shouldn't feel bad about enjoying doing that. You know, and as long as it doesn't take away from all the other things I need to do as CEO, but that's the part that I enjoy the most.
Yeah. There's also this transition from being the entrepreneur, the grinder, the hustler, to then molding into a CEO role. I think you hit on that. Can you give the audience some learning lessons transitioning from being the day-to-day to now having to oversee such a successful organization?
Yeah, I you know, the first time that I was able to kind of see this happen for me personally was when I was at Ernst & Young. I started a new consulting arm of the company that grew to about 1,500 people, and it was a global practice. So we had, I think I had 20 some leaders around the world that reported to me, and then they kind of ran their little geos that they had. That was a great time for me to realize that the knowledge that I had gained about how to do something, how to consult and provide services, and how to package those services were not just valuable to me, but I could teach other people how to do that, and they could go be successful and teach their people how to do that. So that was kind of an aha moment for me on learning that, you know, how to take my knowledge and allow that to be shared with other people, and then to turn them loose to let them go, you know, build and do things on their own as well.
Empowering others, being able to educate somebody into your knowledge, empowering them, being a leader to them, but then letting them go and explore their own options and learn who they are as a boss.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. And I think what I didn't say there is that I learned the importance of hiring the right people, and the time as a leader of that practice, the time that I needed to take to make sure that we hired the right people. Because if we didn't, it didn't just affect me and that person. It affected all the people that they were responsible for, right? It could cause a lot of havoc that was there. So I just learned early in my career, I interviewed every manager and above at Ernst & Young and gave the green light. When I moved to Archer, I had a process. I interviewed and hired every person that we hired into that company. Even as we grew to be a couple hundred people, I still felt like it was important to me to first build a connection with the person, but then I needed everybody else in the organization to know that if it's important for John to interview this person and to take the time, it's important for them to take the time to make recommendations for people they want to hire back to me, you know, before I interview them as well. So that culture kind of all happened from just focused on the right people.
Do you have tips for the audience? As somebody, take myself, for instance, I'm trying to get out of this small mindset, trying to build, trying to delegate more, but I'm scared of who to hire.
Yeah, that's...
Do you have tips?
I'll tell you this. The smaller the company, the harder that is, because you probably have a whole bunch of knowledge and how you do things that's hard for somebody just to come in and pick up on day one. You're always going to make the better decision. And you've got to figure out, how do I give them a little bit at a time so they grow, but how do I allow them to make decisions so they don't always just go to you and create this culture of, you know, you're going to always make the decision to every problem that they have that's there. I'm a huge proponent on having a process in place for hiring people on the software side. You know, we had a standard process of people came in the morning between 8 and 10 to do the interview. I was the third interview that happened. I got comments right before I interviewed the person on what the other two people thought. If I liked that person, I immediately invited them to lunch. I told them right there, we're interested. I'd love to take you to lunch to introduce you with some more people. What we were really doing at lunch is we had a restaurant that we went to with every employee. We sat at the same table that was there. It was called the Archer table. We brought 5 people from other parts of the company, and we just wanted to see how the candidate could interact in a conversation that didn't have to do with business, with our company, just in general. And the easier the conversation, the more we were attracted to the candidate. If the candidate really had a hard time just carrying a general conversation, we knew that maybe our culture, that wasn't our culture. We needed people to be able to communicate very easily back and forth. So we had honed in on that one piece, and we found that when we followed that process and went down that we tended to find the right people because of that. Your business is probably different, but I always encourage, you know, CEOs or founders that what is the most important thing, or the, you know, 1, 2, or 3 most important things in your business that you need from somebody. And let's build a process around that that gets you there. And also realize that you're not just interviewing somebody for you to hire. They're considering whether they want to accept that job from you. In most right. cases, the good ones are going to have multiple offers. So you need to think about, what can I do if I'm hiring somebody and their spouse is involved in this decision? Maybe they're moving. Like, what do I do to maybe send something fun to the spouse? Or do I get the spouse with that person here at the interview to maybe go to dinner with us? Or like, how do you pull them into the mix to create the yes on that side, and not just the candidate?
That's so refreshing to hear. That also you're so knowledgeable on all aspects, because I used to work for Career Builder, which was a large data recruiting company. And a lot of times working with these old inundated HR companies, they're like, well, why would we accept somebody that doesn't want to work for us? And it's, you know, what you basically shared is there's 2 sides of the coin.
Right.
There's always 2 paths to take. And that's one of the lessons that we always try to say, whether basically understanding 2 sides of the story. Really enjoyed hearing that. It was very refreshing hearing that.
Excellent.
It sounds like we're talking about a lot of the butterfly moments, and I'm very excited for your path, very excited for your success. But there has to have been moments where you were questioning yourself. Did I make the right choice? That you were dealing with difficult moments. Can you tell the audience about one of those times?
Sure. Yeah. I'll go back to when we started Archer Technologies back in 2000. And what happened was we had really good traction for the first year. We brought on, I think, 5 or 6 or 7 banks in that period of time. And then 9/11 happened, right? And some of the customers that we had were actually in the buildings that went down. And those customers weren't paying us. And we had to make a decision, like, what do we do? Like, do we call the customer and complain about them not paying us? Or do we just understand that this is, they lost people? Like, there's something bigger that's happening. But for us, we struggled to make payroll. Like, I had to go one day, I drove my Chevy Blazer to the car dealer and said, give me every penny you'll give me. And they said, we're not going to give you much. And I'm like, I got 2 hours to go make payroll. I'll take whatever you give me. Another time I sold my boat, and that time I sold my motorcycle, all during that time to make payroll. And we learned 2 lessons there. Number one is, it was important for our culture as a company not to pressure them to pay us at the time. It was not the right move for us to make, even though it was very painful for us as a young company. And number two, we learned in general that banks are horrific at paying small vendors. So we changed our contracting process very quickly to incent them. If you pay now, this is the price. If you choose not to pay now, it's 20% more, right? Like we little things that we built in because we had they had no incentive to pay the little company getting started. So there's a lot of little tricks that we learned to help get us out of that. But that was like the toughest year period of time that I've ever had in a company, in that we were being successful. We were closing deals, but customers weren't paying. What do you do about that? You never expect that to happen.
It sounds like you're the leader that stood up and fought for your people rather than holding back paychecks. You were doing what you had to do, anything possible to make sure that the people on your team were taken care of. And that's one of the biggest things that we see in companies. You know, a lot of people are very selfish, I guess we could say.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't do things like that. But your ability, your integrity, and the value that you brought to the company, it's obviously grown and it's successful. It's about, I think you said, $750 million company today, where if you had chosen the different path, that may not be the case or story.
But very true. And I think that I learned a great lesson as a leader at that time as well, in that I really didn't know what to do. So the only thing we needed to do was to sit down with our employees and tell them what's happening, right? So, and that honesty paid back in dividends because people just appreciated that we were just telling them, and they knew. They looked in the parking lot and see John's driving an old, you know, it's raining and I had a Jeep that didn't have a top on it. And I'm the CEO of this little company. And it was because we put everything we had into the company just to get us through that year period of time. And then things drastically changed for us. But that moment in time was pretty impactful.
That's great. I'm very happy to have you on. I could talk to you for hours. I know you have a hard stop. So what we're going to do is jump into the fun round real quick. And if you could spare an additional 5-10 minutes with us.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Perfect. Would love to have you back on the show because it seems like we left a lot of stones unturned and you are a very interesting guy. A lot of huge accomplishments and just the integrity and the intrinsic value that you have. I look up to that. Thank you for sharing those stories. As far as the fun round, I ask these questions to all of our guests so that our listeners can get a little bit of a better view of who you are, I guess, as a person, what you like to do, etc. The first question that I always ask is, is there a weird food that you loved as a child and would you still eat it today?
Well, I'd say, you know, growing up in a small town, you know, everything came out of the garden or you raised it in the pasture, you know, your own cattle that was there. I look back on those days. I'll flip the question around a little bit in that, you know, my family would grow these huge tomatoes, right? And I could not stand, I don't know what it was, but I would never have a tomato. And then I'm in my 30s and I go back home. My grandma makes those and I try it. And I'm like, I cannot believe I haven't been eating tomatoes my whole life. Like it was just something so, so different. But in that small town, like I did not have exposure to a lot of food. It was very Southern type cooking for generations in my family. So.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you for that. Two, we always ask, how would your best friend describe you as a teenager?
Ooh, you know, again, I go back to this small town mentality. Everything in the town that I was in was about athletics, right? From the time we were 7, it was baseball, basketball, football, and sometimes there was track and soccer in the same year of that. From the time we were 7 until, you know, through high school, and then a lot of us went on to play sports in college from that town. So it was all about the sports, and it was every night we were at, seems like you're there at practice or at a game with all your buddies, you know, with the parents all sitting in lawn chairs. Like it was just a pretty close-knit kind of group.
So sports oriented.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Sports oriented, like to hang out with friends. If you were stranded on a deserted island, no human contact, no TV shows, nothing, but you could keep yourself entertained with any type of items, you could have even a nuclear reactor, parts of an airplane. What do you think you'd find yourself doing, building, or passing time with?
Yeah, if I had parts to build computers, that's kind of what started me in the tech space, was I had the chance to, I met somebody that taught me how to build, at the time, 286 machines. It's going, people don't understand what that even means. Move to 386, 486, and then kind of the computers that we have today. But I loved just the process of understanding, you know, a motherboard and RAM and memory, and how to connect that to a hard drive, and how to connect that to a card that connects to a monitor, like how those things work is pretty fascinating. So anything like that, I would love to do.
So we'd leave you on deserted island. We'd come find you, and it would probably be the most advanced island on Earth by the time we find you. That's great. So what's your favorite thing to do in your off time?
You know, so my wife and I live in Southern California. She's originally from New York, New Jersey. So we've been out here. I've been here about 20 years. She's been here 10 or 11 now. And we love anything outside. So, you know, that's the first thing that we do every day, is we're outside running, walking, you know, just love to get on the water. Anything kind of sports related and outside is a passion for us.
Most beautiful place you've ever visited.
Well, I'm a little biased, but the place that we have in Southern California with the weather is just so unique that, you know, it's where we're at, it's usually 71 to 73 every day, kind of on the water. Outside of that, the only closest thing that I've seen to that would be in Greece or Italy on some trips that we've had, where the climate is just that nice all the time.
Yeah. Nice. If you could tell your younger self anything, what would it be?
Yeah. I think I had a lot of stress and anxiety when I was first starting out on if I was going to actually make it or not, meaning just like, was I going to have to turn around and go back to where I grew up, you know, from, and live with my parents if I couldn't make it through. I wish I had a little more confidence, you know, in myself to know that, you know, I was going to find a way to make that happen. But at the time, that same insecurity and anxiety helps drive you to do things maybe that you wouldn't do to ensure that you know, that wouldn't happen. But yeah, I wish I would have said, hey, just chill a little bit. It's going to come.
Yeah, it is always a fine balance, because that insecurity, that lack of confidence pushes you to make sure that you succeed. But at the same time, it could also limit your capabilities and force you not to take those risks.
For sure.
Thanks for that. Most impactful book you've read?
Yeah, you know, we mentioned it earlier, Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. That's kind of my go-to book. There's just so many unique stories and pieces that you can pull out of that if you're not just an entrepreneur, but you're somebody that's just interested in how do you take advantage of opportunities in your life or your career. And you hear these stories of all these other people that you think were just at the right place at the right time, and it just magically happened. Then you realize that's not really true. There was a lot behind the story that they did that prepared them for that moment that happened.
It's the 10-year overnight success.
Exactly.
Also, when preparation meets opportunity equals luck.
Exactly.
There's a lot of things that go on behind closed doors, go on before the opportunity presents themselves, that prepares young entrepreneurs to be able to take the leap or be able to take that opportunity. And the only reason I'm diving in a little bit deeper here is because even myself, I get caught up in seeing other people's success, but not really understanding their journey. And Right. You start to compare yourself to these people. Oh, they've done this, they've done that, without truly understanding what it really took to accomplish what they're doing.
Right.
That's we like to say, don't compare yourself to anybody else. Be mindful of your own journey. And just with perseverance, you will get there on your own. You just need that grit, the perseverance, a confidence to know right. that if you keep going, things should work out.
Yeah, so. For sure. I enjoy that as well. I think learning from other people's journeys is important for your own journey, not just looking at their success, but just how did they get there? What did they do? It's just put that in your in the vault for later. Yeah.
Yeah. So last question here. What does the future look like for you?
You know, what I didn't mention earlier is that my wife and my mother were actually involved in the founding of Archer Technologies that did so well. My mom ran the finance and accounting. My wife, Tara, ran sales and marketing, and I kind of did the other parts. We're doing the same thing at SmartSuite. So my wife, Tara, joined us as a founder. She's running the sales part. And then one of the key people I worked with at Archer early on, our CTO, joined us as a co-founder as well. We just enjoy working together. That's where I'm headed with that. Like, we enjoy the friendships that we make with the people around the world that we get to travel and go see what we call customers, but they become really good friends. And that's part of who we are and what we like to do. And that's a big draw for us. Having a company like SmartSuite is it gives us that opportunity to continue that. That was the biggest single part of leaving Archer Technologies when we sold the company that we felt was we missed that day-to-day interaction with so many great people that was there. And we still have great interactions with them, but it was just different because we couldn't cross the line since we sold the company. You know, we kind of had to stay in our lane and let the company do whatever they wanted.
That sounds like such a terrific culture to be a part of. I'm happy to have met you and to hear the successes that you've had. And I believe you will continue to have. So I wish you the best in your journey. And I'll cut it short here. We got a couple minutes before your next meeting. But guys, if you like the advice that you heard here, if you like the things that John was saying, please leave a comment, leave a review, give us 5 stars, give us a follow, and share the episode with your friends. Again, like I was saying, this is not a monetized podcast. My own company is footing the bill because we want to make sure that you hear this message, hear from great people like John. With that being said, thanks, guys, for listening in. We'll catch you next week, and hopefully we catch John on another episode. We'll see you guys later.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.